Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. But not just me, someone else is joining me. Say hello, Juliana.
Hello.
We are going to be reviewing this book together, mainly because we were told to read it. Can you say what the book is, because you've got the page there open in front of you.
So we got this book recommended by listeners. It's called Leviathan Wakes by James S. A. Corey.
Who isn't a person.
No,
turns
not
out
one.
That's actually a pseudonym for two different people. I'd kind of heard this like floating around when people talking about this book. Oh, it's not actually one person. It's this person and this person. It's like fantasy author. And then someone who wasn't an author but was a fantasy author's personal assistant. George R. R. Martin's personal assistant. And weirdly enough, that is one of the top quotes. The George R. R. Martin quote saying kick-ass space opera is one of the top quotes on the book. And you're like, wow, I wonder if he had any reason to say that. Of course, that's just how the publishing system works. But yeah, this came out in 2011 and it's 600 and how many pages long? 611 pages long.
It says 561 pages.
Oh, I obviously had a different edition up on my Goodreads because it said something else. Oh, maybe that was a different page. So that is actually quite a lot bigger book than I thought it was going into it, because it seemed like quite a fluffy book. And then I started reading and I was like, wow, there's like a full novel of stuff has gone past already. And I was only like 40% of the way through. And I was like, okay, so yes, quite a chunky book. But like I say, it was written by like an epic fantasy author and the epic of epic fantasy author's personal assistant. So it's, for me, it doesn't really surprise me that it was actually this big. So, and the reason why we read this is because, like I say, this was recommended to us. People said on the SFBRP listener group on Goodreads, people were saying, hey, this is the most popular recent series that you've not read and reviewed yet. And I was like, that is true. Let us do it.
Let's do it. Also, we kind of finished all the other projects that we had.
Like the other reading series.
To read. Yeah, and then it was just easy to just, oh, wow, it's space opera.
Well, you were looking through this book and you were like, brought it up and you were like, hey, if I just get this on iBooks, you can share it. So we just bought it once as an ebook and we both read through. No audiobook this time out. No Audible plug. Although do go to audibletrial.com/SFBIP and get a free trial. Anyway, so yeah, let's get into this. So the setup is, you know, we're going into this. I didn't know much about it, but it's got like a space opera front cover there. Leviathan Wakes, James S. A. Corey. And so there's spaceships and stuff. But it's not kind of galaxy-spanning space opera. It is like a few small space stations and spaceships within the asteroid belt spanning space opera. And this is one of the things that I wanted to talk about straight away. This for me didn't really feel like space opera at all. How about for you?
No, it wasn't really, because mainly it was like you had these, of course it was happening in space, in spaceships and on space stations, but it never left the place. It was kind of always in the same, like there's the Mars that has a colony on it, Earth of course.
But we never see
Mars.
But
also, no, we would never actually go there. It's always just like, and there's the Martians, and they have a navy, and they want this, and then we have Earth, and they have a navy as well, and they want that. Yeah. And then we have these space stations that are kind of like in put together in this sort of thing that's called the belt.
Well, that is the asteroid belt.
Yeah.
And they get the asteroids and spin them up.
Where?
They spin them up. Well, just between everywhere. Mars and Jupiter.
Yeah, so. Okay, right. So it is quite, I wouldn't say it's like close by in the neighborhood, everything, but it kind of is. It is still like all in our universe.
Yeah. For space opera, where you normally, and this is what earlier, because I just finished this book earlier, and I said, hey, let's not talk about the book until we get to the podcast. But of course, we were nattering away about it.
Of course, we can't.
And I was like, well, for me, space opera, like it has to have kind of like the operatic scale. It can't just be, hey, there's like six named characters in this book and they go from one spaceship to like three other spaceships and there's this one space station and two other space stations, these asteroids, you know. They go from Ceres to Tycho to, what was the other one, Eros or something like that, these three spaceships. And they go from one to the other, and one person says, oh, well, I know what this is like because I grew up on this kind of space station, and they're all the same, so I know my way around it. And I'm like, that, for me, isn't what conjures up space opera. You know, like, even in Star Wars, I once saw this thing about, you know, George Lucas talking about Star Wars. He said, oh, in every movie, I want there to be at least three different planets, three distinct planets, and that's
exactly
what there is.
And they are not even a single time even like one of the storylines.
Yeah.
Nothing takes place on a planet.
But that's not the problem. I'm saying that there has to be different locations. But the location goes from spun up asteroid belt space station, and then they go to another one which has a casino in it, and another one which has bigger windows. That is the variety. Exactly. Otherwise,
but
we're on the inside of spaceships.
Both storylines are like that. There's no variety, and this one storyline is actually happening over there, and it's a totally different environment. No, all the environments that everything takes place is similar. Because it's quite, it's like limited.
Yeah, it feels very narrow. And I saw some of the reviews are saying, hey, it's like Firefly. And it's like, yeah, it's trying to be Firefly. But even Firefly, every episode, they'll be on a different planet. And of course, all the planets look like different parts of California, wherever it was filmed.
Right.
But like sometimes they'd go to the city planet and it would all be, you know, flying around. It'd look a bit like, what am I trying to say? With all the flying cars going around.
Yeah,
and
right.
then they go to this other one, it's all, you know, it's all palaces and people are dressed up and they're doing dueling. And then they go to this other one and it's super high tech. And then they go to a space station and there's lightning going off around it. You know, even a TV show like that feels a lot more space opera-y, even though that's all set within one solar system.
And also in this one, everything is always just mentioned.
Yeah.
We actually don't get to know anything.
There's
about it.
Not a lot of description in this book.
Yeah, the people that we meet originated on a planet, from a planet. One's like an Earther and one is like a Martian.
Yeah, and one's got five fathers and three mothers and stuff like that.
There is fun stuff in it, and maybe, probably when we would continue reading
the series,
like it has five books in total, then we would think, oh yeah, this actually is a space opera. Because
but this book doesn't feel enough.
Expanded.
Yeah.
But this book just by itself, really?
It's like a space opera if at the start of Star Wars they never leave Tatooine and you're like, wow, that's actually not a space opera. That's a story of some people living in the desert. And there are spaceships and there are droids and stuff like that, but it never really feels, which is not it's not a criticism of the book itself. If you want to write a story which happens on three spaceships and three space stations, and the three spaceships are literally so indistinguishable that when they go from one spaceship to the next spaceship, I'm like, oh, which spaceship are they on now? And two of the spaceships have got so much of the same name. One's called the Ravi and one's called the Rassi, and they're having a battle between the Ravi and the Rassi, and I'm like, oh, okay, it would be really handy if you gave them like more different sounding, or not sounding, but like when I was scanning it through, I had to kind of go, oh, which one's the Ravi and which one's the Rassi? And of course, it should already be in my mind, but these Corvette-sized ships, they feel so similar.
This is the kind of stuff that's not made for somebody like you who forgets names of so easily.
I'm not. Well, the thing is, I don't forget names, and it wouldn't matter if the things were distinct enough that I didn't remember them because they had different names. I remember them because the spaceships have different characters. Like, nobody gets mixed up between the X-Wing and the Millennium Falcon because it's like they are different. They have different functions. They have a different size. They have, like, one's a smuggling ship, which is like this. But in here you go, oh, this is a space battleship and here's another space battleship. And this one, its distinguishing feature is we can't see it because it's cloaked. And this one over here, its distinguishing feature is that's also cloaked. And now let's have a battle. And you're like, this isn't helping me. This isn't helping me tell apart these things. And over here is another one. What's the distinguishing factor over there? Well, that's an Earth ship. That's being an Earth ship is not a distinguishing factor of a spaceship. You have to have, you know, spaceships in science fiction have to have characters. You know, there has to have a character of it. You know, the character has to be there.
You mean it doesn't have to have a character itself, but it has to be has to have a characteristic.
There has to be something characteristic about it. And sure, in this one, there is one spaceship which has a lot of character, and it's big. And the character is that it's big and it's going to take the Mormons away. And you're like, okay, this spaceship
is
really
good characteristic.
This is very big. I never got that ship confused with the other ships. And the only thing that actually set apart the main spaceship in this, the what was it called? The Rocinante, was that it had the heroes on it. But otherwise, it was indistinguishable. It happened to beat the rest of them. It was more powerful. But I never actually got in my head what made that ship special. Which, again, isn't bad, but when you're doing space opera, like, these are the things that I actually want. You know, it has to be operatic scale. The characters have to have, you know, like, the spaceships have to have character. The places have to have character. They have to be better described than this.
Let me just explain something. I mean, if you call it space opera, there is there is the root of that word lies in opera.
Yeah.
And an opera is the bringing all the arts together.
Yes.
To like be on like an equivalent level of high art in all the arts. Like you have the scenery.
Yeah.
And you have the costumes, the story, the music,
the acting. Yeah.
All of it is on a high level, and like maybe this is why it feels so much like it, because you have like a. You do have a story, you have characters, but then, as you said, the scenery is just not high level enough to keep up with all the other things there.
And that is, space opera has to have all of these different
elements. Has to have, like, I don't know, planets or certain things that stand out so much that it can keep up with an extraordinary main character.
Yeah.
Or an extraordinary story, an extraordinary journey or whatever. But it has to keep up on the same level.
And this book felt for me very average, because there was only like one or two moments where I thought this is actually extraordinary.
Yes.
Now, it's bad because we were just listening as the audiobook of an Alistair Reynolds book as we were coming over here. Because we went over to, what's that? Yeah. Goodreads readers also enjoyed Alistair Reynolds. Yeah. And we were reading this. I was like, okay, in this book, in Leviathan Wakes, there is someone called the Butcher. Was it the Butcher of...
The Butcher of Anderson Station.
The Butcher of Anderson Station. And on the way home today, we're like, oh, and this person was called the Butcher of Tharsis. And I'm like, yeah, they have the same function, that the old grizzly war hero actually turns out to have been, you know, he did the butcher thing, but it was bad in the past. I'm just like, okay, that's the same thing. And they get into a spaceship in this, in Leviathan Wakes, and they say, this is a Corvette-class ship. And then it was like listening to Alistair Reynolds' audiobook, and then he got into the Corvette and zipped across on. It's like, yeah, when you're chasing someone, a small ship that you want is the Corvette. I'm like, is that a standard thing in science fiction now? In space opera?
Yeah, why is that called? Isn't that a car, the Corvette?
Well, the Corvette is actually a size of ship in the American Navy. You know, it's actually a ship.
Like a ship, like a sailing ship.
Yeah, well, it's not. Well, yeah, it's kind of like that size of ship that you can fit 10 people on, and it goes quickly, and it's got a torpedo or something like that.
All right, so it's like a quick, maneuverable, powerful ship.
I mean, that's just off the top of my head from my own knowing that in the past. But when I read that... When I read that in Alistair Reynolds for the first time, I'm like, oh yeah, the Corvette. You know, we in the prefix, they get into the Corvette.
Yes.
It's like a police cruiser, but it also has that kind of military past and a fast ship kind of feeling. But then when I read in Leviathan Wakes, I didn't have that association. I just thought, oh yeah, just using the same terminology as Alistair Reynolds does in the Revelation space. In this, there is this... again, spoiler territory here, tiny little bit, but there is the melding plague in Leviathan Wakes. It's just one of those things that come in and you're just like, oh, so they're just doing the melding plague. When that turned up, I was like, okay, so now we're doing the melding plague. And then there's all of these... what are you looking for now?
I look up the Alistair Reynolds books to see which one was out before.
Well, these Revelation Space came out like in the 90s, late 90s or something.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, it's way before that. But it was time after time reading this going, oh, this feels like... something from Peter F. Hamilton. This feels like Alistair Reynolds, but everything just less remarkable. And I'm not even saying it's a shorter book. Of course, Alistair Reynolds has long books. Peter F. Hamilton has even longer books. But when we're talking about the Expanse, this is called The Expanse, and it didn't feel very expansive. It just feels like, oh, they've just taken stuff from other science fiction and just put it together. In a way which could be a lot okay, what's that? Revelation Space. When did Revelation Space come out?
Published in 2000.
Yeah, in 2000. So not quite late 90s, but you know, that kind of era. Anyway, so that's kind of the setup. Oh, that's the world. Yeah. We normally talk about the world at the start.
Why is it actually called Expanse?
The Expanse.
I mean, the series. Where does the word come from?
I don't
know.
Well, we didn't look it up on Wikipedia. We only looked up the
book itself.
The book itself, Leviathan Wakes. I'm not sure why it's called The Expanse. Is it very expansive? That's the problem. It never felt that expansive. So anyway, let's get into the story of this. So it sets up, and we have this little prologue, this little prelude, or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
Let me have a look at the contents of the book. Yeah, prologue. Julie, it says Julie, and we get a little bit of Julie. She's on a ship, and some people take over the ship. And you're like,
sounds like pirates.
What's that?
Sounds like pirates taking over the ship.
Yeah, pirates take over the ship, and you're not quite sure what's happening. And then there's not really very much to say there, but we get a little glimpse at Julie. And then it goes, if we look here at the contents of the book,
which is at the front, which is
right at the very book, right at the very front of the book,
you get to see it straight away.
This is what I quite like about audiobooks, is that this stuff is left out, and it kind of leaves a bit of mystery what's going to happen here. Chapter 1, Holden. Chapter 2, Miller. Chapter 3, Holden. Chapter 4, Miller. Chapter 5, Holden. Chapter 6, Miller. Chapter 7, Holden. On and on and on and on and on and on and on, all the way through. Wow, I didn't realize there was this many chapters. Chapter 54, Miller. Chapter 55, Holden. Epilogue, Fred.
And we don't spoil anything, because it is right at the beginning of the book. So if you pick up the book, this is the first thing you read.
Yeah. This is in the book, is saying, hey, these two characters, Miller, Holden, Miller, Holden, Miller. And you're like, wow, 55 chapters plus a prologue. I can't say that. And an epilogue. And yeah. So that's like, what, 57 chapters. Mm. That's a lot of chapters. So they're very short chapters. It's like, you know, a few pages each. I mean, I'm reading it as an audiobook, so I don't know exactly how many pages each. But, you know, what is it, 800 and something pages of the ebook?
You just read it as an ebook.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. As an ebook, I don't know how many pages each, but not many pages each. So the action goes from one to the other, to the one to the other. And we know that these two characters are going to make it through all the way to the end, which is not a very clever way of writing a book.
It's like, it's weird. If you publish it, your book, and then you kind of spoil it right from the beginning. That clever.
I don't think so.
I noticed it straight away.
What? This thing?
This setup.
I kind of skipped past it. But once I understood what was going on, I realized, okay, we're going backwards and forwards between these two characters. Which, again, wouldn't be a problem. However, a lot of the tension in this book is, will this character survive? They get into a spaceship battle. Will they get out of the other end? And you're like, yeah, of course, because we're only 55% of the way through the book. And if one of these characters dies, that's it. They're not gonna hang around after they're dead, except maybe they don't. And anyway, we'll get more onto that later.
I mean, but that would have been really clever.
It could have been more clever
if they actually would have died and then from like somewhere talked back into the story or something.
There was a book that came out a few years ago, won the Hugo Award and the Nebula Award, by Pablo Bacacalupi, called The Wind-Up Girl. One of the main characters in there, I mean, it's like some detective story like this, one of the main characters dies half the way through. And you're like, whoa, but that means we lose one of the best characters. But they don't, because they stick around in the person's head and they just imagine them being with them in the kind of like a psychological coping mechanism. Mm. And they stick around as a character in the mind of one of the characters that does it. And they talk backwards and forwards to each other, and they inform what's going on, and they help out and point things out. And as you're going through, it was like, is this really happening? Oh, no, it's kind of a psychological thing going on there. But for me, it was really interesting to have one of the main characters dead and then the other person and just continue on with them in the mind. And I was reading this book, Leviathan Wakes, and I'm just like, again, even what could have been the most impressive thing or the best thing about this was because when they, you know, one of the characters is dead, but then continues living in one of the characters' minds, and, you know, there's a bit of that weird obsession, kind of midlife crisis, brain falling apart, psychological breakdown, but having someone with them there in their brain thinking about it, I'm just thinking, even this was done better in another science fiction book, which was very popular. It was popular enough to win the Hugo.
No, you just spoiled it for me.
What, the Hugo and...
No,
what?
I didn't read it yet.
Well, it's a really good
book. The Wind-Up Girl.
No, that doesn't really spoil it. It doesn't really spoil it. I mean, maybe, but there's lots of other stuff to go on in that book. Okay. That's not the main thing. Whereas in this book, for some of those characters, that was the only interesting thing going on in the character. And I'm thinking, even this feels like just warmed over, stick it in the microwave, we'll eat this again sometime.
And the weird thing about this is that even though we just pointed out that the two main characters that switch chapters one after the other, at the beginning it felt very much to me like, oh, and you know this little children's verse like saying, oh, and 10 hunters went into the woods and 9 hunters came out of the woods and then 9 hunters came back into the woods and 8 hunters went out of it.
What, like,
that,
with
at
one
the beginning,
of the, yeah.
It really felt like that to me, and I thought, well, why these people? And
what, like that they kept on surviving, whereas other people kept on dying?
Yeah.
And there's some of this dies and then they go out and they come back. Yeah, I have not really much of a problem, but it did feel like that first half of the book was, hey guys, let's get the cast together. And you're like, really? This is the group of people
them together as quickly as possible so we know that we will spend the rest of the time with these guys.
Because
these are the best guys. Yeah, we already sorted out all the others that are not necessary right at the beginning.
Yeah, it did feel a bit like, hey, let's par this down to a good cast of characters.
Let's kill off all the unnecessary people right at the beginning and then spend the rest of the time, like, I don't know, when it was that, like, the people died, like, probably in the first 20% of the book. And 80% of the book were then just with the
survivors. And you thought, well, they're going to make it through to the end. Yeah, I never felt, you know, there's these secondary characters who are flying around in the Corvette. You know, like, was it Naomi, Alex, and Amos? Yeah, like you say, once the people who weren't them died, spoilers, oh, that's right at the start of the book, it doesn't matter. Like, lots of people die, but they survive. But yeah, once you get past that first 25%, you never think they're in danger. You always think, oh, well, these are now the characters that we're going to spend the rest of the book with and maybe the rest of the series with. I didn't realize it was that clearly a series. Yeah, so that's cool. Also, as another thing that kept on happening, when we were switching backwards and forwards between these two viewpoints, we were switching backwards and forwards. There's a story going on over here, and then we go over here. Now, this I don't mind if it's done well. Like
cleverly.
But what I don't like is that we skip away from someone. There's a conversation, and someone says, and now I'll pass you over to you. And the other person says, okay. And then we go off, and we go back to, say, that was Holden's chapter. Then we go across to Miller, and Miller does something that's like, and then the next day he got up and did this, and then he went to bed, and then he woke up the next day, and then this happened. And I'm like, okay, so that's 24 hours, 48 hours have gone past in Miller's story. And then we go back over to Holden, and it picks up immediately 1 second later, or the next second. Do you know what I mean? So, like, in one timeline, 1 second has passed, and in the other timeline, 48 hours has passed. I don't mind that happening, but it's, like... I mean, that could be done well, but for me, it just felt clumsy. It's like, oh, we have to skip across because I want to leave it on a cliffhanger here. And then we go over here and do that other stuff. And then we come back and it's like, but if something happens 1 second later and the other bit of storyline takes 48 hours, like, how do these two go together?
You know what I was just thinking?
What?
Maybe this is how they wrote the book.
What?
One of the guys got Miller and one of the guys got Holden and then they brought it all together.
Maybe, I don't know.
I mean, that would make sense.
My big problem was when the two characters come together. Because when it was like, when they were in a unique situation, when Holden was with his crew and Miller was doing his detective work, it was fine. I knew which ones were different. But then it came together, and because both of them are told in third person, when they were both in the same room as each other and stuff was happening, I didn't know which one was the viewpoint character at that point. And then it would switch across, like one of them would say something and then it would switch to the other character in the next chapter and they'd repeat that last line again and go into it. And I made a note on Goodreads on my review, one of my reading updates. It was like, I have to, and on a paragraph by paragraph basis, I had to keep thinking, okay, who is the viewpoint character now? Who, like, how much does this character know? And when Miller speaks, are we, and then something happens, like, are we seeing it from his point of view or Holden's point of view? And it was too difficult for me to work out just by context. I had to go, like, I had to go look, not look back at the start of the chapter. I think I even did this.
No, you did it. Yeah. And I actually did the same.
Yeah.
Not only once.
Yeah, the writing isn't clear enough.
Yes, it is not. Like, if you have this kind of swapping chapters between characters, I would always prefer going from first person.
What, a first person to another first person?
Yes.
Or how about going from someone who isn't a middle-aged, good-looking, like, white guy, superhero, to another, like, middle-aged, like, good-looking but not good-looking, kind of, like, failed, but, like, both of them, like... And you were complaining a bit about this before. It's like so totally macho. Like one of them is the most amazing guy who's got an amazing moral compass, but is a bit naive. And the other one is this amazing, clever guy who thinks he's clever. You know, it's one of those things that when going from one character to the other, even though they were distinct and they did have distinct personalities, the writing about what they were doing wasn't distinct enough.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, the characters were distinct, but how it was written about them, I never felt like anything was good. There was no tonal change to the writing. Like,
no,
one of them was a Martian.
Really.
No, I mean, one of them was from...
One of them was an Earther.
No, one of them was a Martian, but he had like, that family. He had an 8-person family. He had 5 fathers and 3 mothers.
Oh, I thought Holden was from Earth.
No. Oh, maybe. No, I think it was... Oh, I'm not sure. I thought he was just inner planets. Maybe he was from Earth. Ah, maybe, again, that thing, that should have been...
We have here the expansewikia.com.
Okay.
Where we can click on the characters' names and hopefully it will tell us where they actually were from.
Where is he from?
He's an Earther.
He is an Earther. Okay, well, who's from Mars then? Okay.
He has pale skin, blue eyes, and dark, short, cropped hair.
Yeah, and he's so good-looking that all the women just fall in love with him.
Holden grew a beard, which came in patches of various length and curl. What?
Color. Okay, forget about that. Weird. Again, not even the characters are distinct. Some of them are told, and this person is very ... tall. And you're like, okay. And then Julia Mayo. No, not Julia Mayo. That's Paula Mayo from...
Julie Mayo.
No. Is it Mayo?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's a name.
Yeah. A bit like Paula Mayo from...
how can you come up with that?
Okay. Anyway, so she was like, and at one point she was like, oh, and when he actually saw it for real for the first time, her chin was slightly wider than he imagined. And I'm like, but we never knew what size her chin was. Like, I understand what they were going for in that thing. Sometimes the writing really does stand out. I mean, there is some really nice stuff. I like it when he goes, the circle of life on Sarah's was so small, you could see the curve. He liked it that way. And I'm like, oh, that's some quite nice writing. You know, there is sometimes, and Alex was talking about when he was stuck in this thing because he was a pilot and they got waylaid somewhere and everyone was stuck in this room. He says at the end of it, six of them got married and the rest of us never spoke to each other again. And, you know, there are some really good turns of phrase in this book. There is quite a lot of writing which I actually quite liked, but I'm just saying there was nothing distinctive between the chapters. We were skipping from one to the other and I just didn't know sometimes who we were with.
I actually think the better way of doing it would have been if they would have had Miller and Naomi as the characters.
Yeah, Naomi's
Why
story is
not?
Just as good.
Is she's just like, and you would have very distinctive characters.
Yep.
And she's so much, she's so different from Miller that you would immediately know that you're with her instead of with Holden.
And her emotional journey with Holden. Yeah. Naomi's emotional journey with Holden is much more interesting than
her
point of view than Holden's emotional journey with Naomi.
And he's so ignorant.
Yeah. It would have been so better that if
let's talk about Holden.
Okay, but Holden is if we're going back to Firefly, he is Hal, but Hal who isn't okay with just shooting the bad guy. You know, Hal's character where he, in that first episode, where I almost called him Castle then. Hal, where he just walks up and just shoots the guy. He just walks up and shoots the guy. That was a reaction to the Han Solo shoots first. Han shoots first.
Yeah.
You know? And that was a thing. They said, we wanted that moment right at the very beginning in that first pilot episode of him just walking up to someone and they're being in a bad situation. He just takes out his gun, bang, shoots it, solves the problem, goes on like that. And what we have is that with Miller, but then Holden is meant to be like the Firefly, lead with the Firefly kind of guy who's good and he knows what he's doing.
I mean, at the beginning, he's the first command. He's
like just the first officer.
And then
he becomes a pilot. No, he becomes the captain.
He becomes captain. And in my opinion, he doesn't earn it at all.
No, he earns it by the people above him
dying. I quite like it here on the Wikia, expense Wikia thing.
Yeah.
There's some fan art showing him in a spacesuit. And hugging his coffee machine. This
yeah.
is how he feels to me. He feels like, I don't know, I wouldn't say whiny, but he's like all like, I don't know. And he's just in so many ways so stupid.
Naive. I think naive is the word.
And as a captain, you can't really do that.
But that's the thing that suddenly qualifies him to do it. It's like they're going, oh, if we press this button, we might explode. And they're like, oh, well, we shouldn't. Like, this is Naomi really thinking about it, using a brain. But if we press this, we might explode. Maybe it turns. And he just comes up and goes, boop, press the button. And she's like, oh, I could never do that. I could never just take charge of the situation and do that. It's like, that's not taking charge. That's just rushing in headlong.
Yeah.
You know, that reminds me of Han Solo, where he's, you know, on the Death Star.
Mm.
And they run and run and run and they're chasing the stormtroopers, and then the stormtroopers turn around and they're like, oh, they should actually be chasing us. And it's like, yeah. Like that turning around. And that's every time that this happens, that actually made me what we think of, but not in a good way, not in a like, yay, shooting it, stupid conversation anyway. Not in a kind of clever, like cocksure, I've been in this situation loads of times before and I've managed to get myself out by the power of my wits. It's just like, stuff's happening. I'll react by doing this.
Yeah.
You know.
Also, he's like, he's getting influenced by other people so often. I think I made one note about this here, where
Fred,
he said, I agree, Holden said, it's like quite towards the end. Miller suggested this, and then he was kind of like thinking about it and said, all right, I think, I agree. I don't have another plan. So we just do that.
Yeah.
Although he really thinks that there's something really weird going on with Miller and he's not quite insane and he's really struggling to include him in anything. And then suddenly, all right, Miller suggested that I don't really have another idea. Well, let's just do it.
Yeah.
And this is not the only time. It's like,
no, it happens time and time again.
He gets it, like he's talking to Naomi and then he's taking her ideas. Then he's talking to this other guy of the... Fred, and he time and time again that he takes just the ideas of other people and just execute them, because he doesn't have other ideas by himself. And it's just like, it feels like, and then he gets planted into a situation where people want him to do it, and then he does it. Then somebody else tells him, oh, you know that you just started a war. And he said, no, I just told the truth.
Yeah.
And then it's and that just happens, like, oh.
But this is the weird, this is the thing that I didn't get. Like, a character is actually saying to him, you're being really stupid. You keep doing the same thing over and over again. You keep being used by people bigger than you to turn this thing around, and then millions of people are dying. And he's like, oh, but I'm just... And then it's explained to him. And then at the end of the book, what happens? They're like, oh, let's do this thing. Don't want to give it away. We'll get onto some spoiler territory later. But he gets onto the thing. It's like, oh, then there's all these nuclear weapons. Well, let's just hand all the power over these nuclear weapons over to this guy over here. And then in the end, you're like, you do realize you just gave all these nuclear weapons to this other guy. And he's like, oh, really? Oh, that should work out fine. It's like, the person you gave it to him is called the Butcher of Tharsis Bulge. That's not... No, that's...
Anderson
that's,
Station.
That's, yeah, that's Alistair Reynolds. It's the Butcher of Anderson Station. It's like, don't... Even if you think he's a nice guy now, don't give all the nuclear weapons to that guy, you know.
Anyway, so this is just my... That was just my whole opinion about him all the time. And I was thinking, like, wow, and... Naomi, really? Like, what do you even think about this?
But I mean, he's got dreamy eyes. And she fell in love with him when he didn't take advantage of this. When he didn't rape this other woman, that was the thing that turned him on.
Nice.
Well, it wasn't raping. But it was one of those times where you just go, oh, so this is she's going to be the prize? Like, and it made me think of that time, actually, with Miller. We'll get onto Miller in a second, but when... Actually, let's just get onto Miller now.
All right.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
I mean, but I'm just wanting to say, like, her getting stuck with him at the end kind of felt like her punishment for sticking around too long. You know, in the same way that when Miller recognizes that him being with somebody else, she's not, like, his new partner in the police force as a detective.
Yeah.
She's not his punishment. He is her punishment. Like, that's the kind of thing. And it felt like at
that
the end of this...
That was actually... I found that part...
Yeah, that's
really,
what I want to talk about.
Really
but
clever.
It felt like a bit like that with Naomi at the end. It's like, well, Naomi, you are not this person's prize. It's like the other way around. It's like, actually, he's your prize. Your prize for surviving this long.
Yeah.
And that's why I think it's like, why didn't it go that way around in that like if he had been her destination for longer than she had been his, well, not destination, her thing that she had been looking at as an object of desire, it'd been that way around for longer than it had been for Jim for Holden, because it was, she even said at one point, it's like, no, you only like me because I'm the only female left in your life. And that was really sad. And then he gets her anyway. And I was like, no.
He didn't deserve her.
No, he didn't deserve her. She deserved him in a way, but it wasn't told from her point of view, which is...
Which is why I really like this fan art on this Wikipedia page. There.
Because it wraps him up.
It really shows him.
Yeah.
A bit like a dreamy character hugging his coffee machine.
Yeah, there was a coffee machine in that spaceship.
That's him.
In the Rossi.
All right, let's go to Miller.
Miller, you asked me a question when I was reading through. I said, hey, I said, he seems a bit too stereotypical police detective, drunken, alcoholic, lost his wife, but really good at his job and doing all this. And you said, write that down if you actually... No, what did you tell me to write down? I can't remember. But
no, you were just reading in the middle of it, and I just asked you, how is your opinion about this character? And then I wanted you to write this down.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because for
he
me...
He seemed almost overly stereotypical as a noir-style detective cop.
Like
person.
Everything that you imagine that a cop... make like that attributes that makes a cop in your opinion like a cop
like a noir detective.
Why you would read about a cop is because he lost his wife, and now he went to drinking too much, and then he kind of struggles but kind of gets through, and he was a good detective once but not anymore.
Yeah.
And you know what I was really annoyed by?
What?
We got to know him as a not a good, like an okay person. He did his job, but he wasn't the detective anymore as that he thought he was.
Yeah.
And this is the problem. I never got any like he was never a sympathizing
sympathetic
sympathetic character to me, not in any.
But he doesn't need to be, as long as he's an interesting character.
But he's not.
No, well, the thing is, really, the first half of the book, he wasn't an interesting character to me.
Yeah.
Like, he was someone who had a job, find this person. But even then, that whole story didn't interest me at all, because there was stuff going on in the background. Like, sure, they needed to set up, like, where the missing riot gear was. Where did all the underworld people go? You know, all of that was already... That was all being set up, and that was his function at the start.
But he got help with everything, and he even pointed it out to himself at the one point when he realized it. He never did anything by himself, actually.
Yeah, it was all his partners and other people that he was working with.
And other, like, the Belter, the OPA character.
The Outer Planets Alliance.
Yeah. So there was one on Ceres that actually gave him all the hints that he needed.
Yeah, now, I don't mind that, but it was quite a cool moment where he realized, actually, he was the stereotypical noir detective washed-up guy, and he didn't have the skills. And then he got he gets fired, but, you know, loses his job. And when that went through, I didn't have a big problem with that. And I thought, well, this is going to... And then his character did turn a bit more interesting when he became Lethal Weapon, when he's like, oh, I've lost my wife, I've lost this, I've lost my job, I'm just going to do whatever it takes now to take down the bad guys and do it. And he took on that character, the nothing to lose detective.
Yeah.
But even then, he never really... He did solve some problems, and he did find what he was looking for, and he did solve the case. But it never made me think that, like, why wasn't he doing that before? Was it just him becoming an alcoholic because he lost his wife? Or what else was it? You know, it turns out he was supremely capable at everything he did. He was very good at the riot control. He was very good storming the space station. He was very good being this crew member. He was very good at shooting the right person at the right time. He was very good at tracking down the spaceship. And I was like, well, why would you fire this guy? And I understand why he was fired, but it never felt like his story really, like, had a proper thread that went through, which explained why he was sometimes good at his job and sometimes he wasn't. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Which was, again, if this had been really competently written, that could have been a very interesting journey for that character to go on. But for me, it just felt uneven. It felt like sometimes he was being written by one author and sometimes he was being written by another
author. Exactly. This is the reason why I wanted you to write this down, that you wrote down in that situation.
Yeah.
Because for me, I was switching between I'm super annoyed by that character and then I'm super bored by that character, and then I was not interested in that character, and it was
but then sometimes
changing.
You were interested
and
in
then
him.
at the end
yeah.
I was somehow interested how it would go, so it was never the thing is that I was never quite sure what my emotions towards this character were.
And this sounds like we're complaining a lot about this book, but what it comes down to is it was just average all the time. Like, for me, when I was reading it, like, this whole first half of this book, I was just like, well, this is kind of quite average noir spaceship detective. Spaceships over here, detectives over here, and it could have been an interesting mystery, but we already knew what happened to it. Like, the prologue is it the prologue or the...
Yeah.
The prologue is called Julia, and this prologue... Julie. This prologue starts off on this ship which gets taken over. And in Holden's first chapter, they arrive at that ship. And in Miller's first chapter, he is told, let's try and find Julie. And I'm like, okay, so there wasn't even the mystery of, like, ooh, these two storylines, one's over here on the ship and one's over here on the space station, they're going to come together in a mysterious way. And it's like, no, it's not going to be mysterious, because they started off with, like, there's a character that ties them both together. One is like, you're in the right location, you're looking for the right character. There was never any mystery to me. I mean, what happened to her? Where was she? What happened to that ship?
Mm.
Those are the mysteries, but there was no mystery of where the story was going.
And if they would get
if they would get together and meet up in the same place, it's like, that's what's, you know, you could just set that up at the beginning. Now, what actually was happening was mysterious, and I think we should actually move on to spoiler territory. Let's set off the incomparable spoiler horn. that's the horn.
It looks like a horn there. Yeah. on the
wave file. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, this just means that from this point on, we're gonna talk about what happens in the second half of the book. So if you've not read this book, what would you say? Actually, we should have said this before. Ignore that previous spoiler horn. Say, do you think this book is worth reading? How many stars would you give it? Just before we get into the big spoiler territory here. I would give it like 2.5 stars. You said about three stars.
Yeah.
Because it is, for me, just average. It's too long for the book. It's too long. But I don't mind too long too much, as long as it keeps my interest all the way through. I never thought I wasn't going to finish it, but nothing about this book grabbed me. Everything I was reading, I was just like, this is just Peter F. Hamilton, Alistair Reynolds, and some other science fiction and other things just like taken wholesale from other places and just gone, well, let's just include some of that in there. And it never felt like it had a world of its own. Even at the same time, I was thinking, oh, they're terraforming Mars. That sounds a bit like Red Mars and Green Mars and Blue Mars by Kim Stanley Robinson. And guess what one of the factions was called on Mars? There was the Blue Mars faction. I'm like, now you're just name-dropping other science fiction, other much better classic science fiction. You're just kind of name-dropping that in there. I've not read those Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars for years, but like they were... It's kind of a pivotal work in science fiction about Martian terraforming. And if you're going to talk about Martian terraforming, it's probably best not to reference them at all, not even in a clever way. And then, oh, the Blue Mars faction, they're worried about the terraforming of Mars. And I'm like, really? That's what you're going for? So,
now, what I was thinking all the time was that there are several storylines in that book, which is quite chunky.
Yeah.
And none of these storylines is actually... really, they never go the path just in that direction. So there are these three
now we're getting opponents. Into spoilers.
Yeah, in there, of course. So let's start. Holden is starting a war. Let's just put it this way, because
Holden's the idiot. He starts a war like three times.
And we have four times. Three parties. We have Earth,
Mars,
yeah, and the outer belt. Outer Planetary Alliance.
And then the belt is kind of in between those, and they're trying to stay neutral sometimes.
Yeah,
and not,
but yeah. I wasn't sure if the belt were actually a separate faction, or if the Outer
Planet Alliance,
they were something. Anyway, so we had all these, we had the whole war story going on, and why, who wanted to go to war, why, and why. And
the most boring war story.
And why these these fractions were so against each other. I mean, it's kind of set in, like, you have several conversations about it and hints why. But then this is kind of like, towards the end is kind of dropped somewhere at the end.
Now it's just a war happening because there's a war happening.
Because it's handy to have that war, right?
The thing is, all the way through, the war was just a distraction. Like, the war was happening for no reason. It's just that they needed a distraction. Now, that, for me, is a total massive plot hole, because only someone who is in the League of Evil would just do that. And it turns out they are actually fighting against the League of Evil. But, like, all of that stuff going on there... it just never felt real to me that these people would be willing to kill each other and to kill people. And they're like, oh, well, they're willing to kill you because you speak in a funny accent and you're a bit taller than other people. I'm like, really? That's it? That's the way we're going for? Now, I do understand that because of racism, even in Europe at the moment, you know, you do get that kind of stuff going on. But for me, what did the Outer Belt Alliance have that Mars really wanted? It was never went into it. It's like, Mars really wants to start a war here because they're of this factor, this economic factor X, or this, you know, like when you say, oh, well, we went to war in Iraq because of 9/11 or whatever. It's like, no, it's about oil. And this war over here, no, well, that's actually about oil as well. Over here, no, in like Arrakis, it's like, all of this is because of the spice, you know. The only time I actually ever understood why there was actually fighting going on in this book is because of the cheese war. You know, he said, oh, he told that story about like cheese. Yeah. And cheese was coming from Earth, and that was the most expensive thing, and everyone home from the police locker with cheese.
I do understand that Mars wanted to be independent from Earth more.
But
maybe that
was it. No, they had their own navy. They had their own thing. They weren't part of the United Nations. What were the the whole, oh, we want to be independent. I'm like, okay, you want to be independent. But I never really understood why suddenly people would think Mars would start a war with the belt.
The politics behind that kind of, so I am a Martian and so I'm different from an Earther person.
Yeah.
Or I'm a Belter, so I'm different from Earth and Mars. And it is not really a big enough reason to put a war in place just as a distraction.
Yeah. It's like, and again, the people weren't, the people that we met, like there was this Earther person, he was fighting on the side of the Altepa, and there was this other person from Mars, and he was also fighting for this other people. And then this person here, and Fred, he was also there, but he was fighting on that side. He even says, oh, everybody I know from the Earth and Mars system seems to be okay, and they're not fighting about anything. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, because... maybe it was just because there wasn't enough stereotypes in that the only thing that everyone... oh, they speak funny and are tall. Really? That's it?
And it's all the time. Speak funny and tall? It's like, Naomi is a belter and Holden is the earther. Oh, here we go. We have the love story between the two.
It's a Romeo and Juliet starstruck.
Oh, come on. And the whole crew of Holden, one of them is a belter, one of them is a Martian, and one of them is... oh, come on. Like,
yeah.
Really?
It's like, hey,
and these
why
are the people.
We...
these are the people that are left over after like the other people were all got killed.
Yeah, it's like...
they were just not...
it's like United Colors of Benetton in the crew.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm not sure... I'm not talking about skin color. I'm talking about, oh, this is from this person. They speak in that lingo, and this is... and but I never... again, it was one of those things that I never understood where the racism came from. But maybe that's it. Maybe, I don't know. I think I actually read, like when I was flicking through those Goodreads, someone actually said the war was all about racism, but everyone looked too much alike to there to be racism.
Yeah.
So maybe that was like a clever satire on like on racism that actually we're all the same. But I just think it's bad writing. I mean, maybe not bad writing, but kind of just like, oh, there's war stuff going on. We don't need to worry about that. And
like,
a lot of
even
the time,
in the far future, we humans will still be stupid enough to just start wars for nothing. Maybe that is the message.
Well, I understand that when you go, okay, what started the First World War? Well, it was this Franz Ferdinand was shot in Serbia or whatever it was, you know. And you're like, well, actually that wasn't. There was a lot of other stuff going on there. But we never understood what all that other stuff going on was when this spaceship was shot down.
Yeah.
Like, what was bubbling under there? Like, what economic stuff and what territorial stuff? And what was all the stuff that was going on which was ready to bubble over and this one thing set it off?
And I still didn't really understand the whole why.
Let's move on.
So, and then you have... So you have the war on the one hand. Then you have the...
melding plague.
The disease that made people
No. Okay, let's set this up. What happens is...
all right.
Well, let's go into this. We're looking for Julie. What's happened to Julie? We don't know what's happened to Julie. Something's happened to Julie. Let's go and find it. And then they turn up and suddenly open the door. Julie's been taken over by something. Now, at this point, it could have been a really good mystery. Something's happened to Julie. She's got black stuff growing out of her stuff. You know, she's going on here. You know, what's happening? What could this be? What could this possibly be? And then they hide a bit and then they run and suddenly it's like, it's vomit zombies. And I was like, really? Now we're doing zombies? Vomit zombies? And it got to that point where I was just like, oh, so this is it. And it's this big experiment. Then what happens is they fly somewhere else, find the League of Evil's PowerPoint presentation that says, actually, let's just wrap up this mystery. And I looked at it, it was like between 50 and 55% of the way through the book. They go, this massive mystery from all the way through the first part of this book. What we're going to do now is give you all the answers in a handy PowerPoint presentation. And you're just like, that's it? That's all the answers? And I was like, but we still got 40% of the, like, once that kind of shook out, 40% of the book left. What's the big mystery now? What's going on now?
What am I called Dresden.
He's got his name is Dresden.
Is that supposed to be some kind of like hint?
What? That is German.
Yeah, that's a German city.
I don't know.
Dresden,
they're gonna firebomb Dresden. Yeah. I don't know what that is from.
Like, this whole book also is full of little like, oh, I'm so clever. Well, you won't guess how I did come up with the name of the spaceship.
And then they just tell you.
Come on! It's
four times. Four times it tells us that spaceship was named after Don Quixote's donkey.
Yeah, like, come on, horse. People! Really, if you write a book, you hopefully hope that people read books before in their lives. You really hope. Don't give it like an obvious name, like of the guy who's fighting against windmills, and then pointing out, oh, look here, that Holden guy is fighting against windmills. Did you not realize that? And then it in the end turns out, oh, and Miller, he got it.
He knew me so well that I would like to name her that. Now, I don't know that story well enough that I would pick up all of the names from that. But even, but if you just explain it to me four times in one book where the name comes from of this spaceship, you know, it came back to me, like, in Firefly, with the TV series, it's like he named it Serenity. Oh, is that after Serenity Valley, after this, you know, where the brown coats lost their war? It's like, yeah. That's a weird thing to name your ship. It's brought up there, but it's brought up as... I know, because it's own. That's the history in that world. That's not our world.
It's not our world.
Yeah, it's not our history.
This I actually made a note, like right at the beginning, page 152, where Miller ate a bowl of vat rice and textured protein that approximated teriyaki chicken. So who needs to know that? Is it actually that Miller needs to know that it tasted like almost like teriyaki chicken, which I'm supposed he never actually tasted? So, you know, when a story is told from the point of view of a character in the book and you put in historical, from their point of view, historical facts, are you putting it in to show that they actually are good in their own history? Or is it to show us
what it would be like for them?
What it would be like for them. But then they don't really actually, shouldn't really know that.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, other authors do this. Alistair Reynolds does it all the time in his books. He says, oh, it's a bit like this. And he brings up stuff from the year 2000 or whenever he wrote the books. And it kind of makes sense because it's from that third person, like more of an omniscient third person than a close third person, that we realize that story is being told to us from someone who knows the whole story but is outside of it and is explaining things to us. Whereas in this, it's often a bit too close to the characters, you know. I don't mind that so much. Anyway, what I wanted to get back to is this melding plague thing that happens.
Oh, yeah.
And again, I don't want to bring it back to Alistair Reynolds, but it feels very, very similar to like that kind of stuff that happens in Alistair Reynolds' books. You know, it feels like, I'm not saying it is the same thing, but it's like there is nothing there that makes me think, oh, wow, I would have never have guessed that this was happening. Because when they were said, like, as soon as we saw Julia and we're like, oh, there's stuff growing out here. I was like, I was just like, okay, which of these boxes is going to be ticked? This is a military weapon experiment. This is some kind of AI that's got out of control, or this is something to do with aliens. And I was like, this could be an interesting thing. Which one is it going to be? I reckon we find out on page 844 of page 800 and something. Oh, this is ebook numbering here. Mm. Like, we will find out 50 pages before the end what this mystery is, and then we'll have maybe some space battle or chase or something, and then it'll all shake out and that'll be it. But no, it was like 40 pages later, PowerPoint presentation, it's aliens. And
by
I'm like,
bad guy.
Yeah. It's like, hey, I'm League of Evil, what was his name? Darren Dresden or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And you're just like, well, here I am.
This is what we want to
do. And then I thought, well, he's now going to be the main bad guy, and it's going to actually be this thing is going to be, you know, it's going to turn out to be good, but he's going to be wanting to destroy it. And then it's like, no. Miller just shoots him in the face, which, to be honest, I understand. And then people were saying, no, he did the right thing. And Miller's like, no, I did the right thing. And other people, yeah, you might have done the right thing. Holden's, no, you did the wrong thing.
The thing with this character, as I said before, is that when he's standing there, of course he has no like weapon in the obvious way of like shooting a pistol. But his weapon, obviously, as we all knew before when we saw the PowerPoint presentation and we knew how he made the Earth, giving him all the resources that he needed.
The protogen.
Yeah.
Yeah, the
so he's really good, obviously, in talking and manipulating people. So that is obviously his weapon. This is his evil weapon.
Yeah.
So, and then he stands in front of all these people.
And they just let him talk.
And they just let him talk, which is his weapon.
Yeah, but and Miller knew what to do.
Miller knew what to do, anyway. But, so we have this... storyline, which is a storyline by itself, obviously.
What, that whole Julia story, the whole, and the like, protogen stuff?
What happens? Also, what I found really interesting, this brown vomit stuff that they...
The vomit goo.
That is the disease, kind of.
The proto-molecule.
When they are still on Eros, the crew, they're running around getting chased by those guys and by... everybody kind of like in that situation they get chased by everyone.
I quite like that section.
How can they manage not to infect themselves?
No, it for me it was really weird in the infection. It was either does the story mean that they should be infected? If not, they don't get infected by not taking any kind of real big precautions. should someone be infected in this situation? Yes, they shall be. So, okay, let's just infect them. I never really worked out, like, sometimes why someone would be infected and why somebody wouldn't be infected.
Yeah.
Oh, it's not airborne. Yeah, it's like, well, it's not airborne, but it's all over the place and sometimes, and they're running through it and treading in it. Yeah. So for me, it did feel a bit convenient, but I don't mind that. That wasn't a big issue for me. Yeah, but I do understand what you mean about these unconnected storylines. The war storyline, sure, the war was just a distraction, but in the end, in the book, the war is just a distraction.
But it is a big part at the beginning.
Yeah, about the war.
Yeah.
But then it's kind of just dropped. And there's war, it becomes background. But again, when we go back to like the prefect, you know, by Alistair Reynolds and this whole thing, this faction is wanting to take over the glitter belt.
Yeah.
And there's this thing, and there's this space station gets taken over. Not quite like this, but it is one of those things. Oh, yeah. We need this biomass, and we need to get everyone together, and there's different things. And you're like, oh, that kind of makes sense that this is going to be taken over and this is going to happen. But again, it felt like this, oh, we're in a space station. We've got to escape from a space station that's being taken over by vomit zombies. And that middle of the book felt so much like the middle of the prefect.
Yes.
Like, there's this group, and they're stuck on this ship, and the space station, they need to get off because it's being taken over. Of course, in the case of the prefect, by the inside of that thing is being taken over. But other people didn't know it had been shut off. And it's the same thing with this. The whole story
was leading to this as one of the main storylines. And here, it's like, you have all these storylines that are kind of like, you spend a lot of time with it, but then it's not really like pulling you so much into it that it's actually the storyline. This is like what we're interested in.
The only thing that was kept, like after that PowerPoint presentation and the guy was shot, you know, it was just like, well, what happens now? And it's like, well, they have this problem that Eris is sitting there and they've got to deal with it. And I was like, when are they going to take the, I was going to say Chekhov's gun, but it's like the Mormon spaceship Chekhov's gun on the wall. They keep on talking about, hey, we've got this really big ship here. This really big ship. It's the most powerful ship.
It's called Naboo.
The Naboo.
like Naboo.
We've got Naboo's gun on, Chekhov's Naboo on the wall here. When is it going to be used? For me, at the end of the book, that was the only thing that I was... That's the only thing. It's like, how is this going to be used? And again, don't want to bring it back to Alistair Reynolds. I was thinking, well, maybe they should just attach it to this spaceship and fire it off. Because, slight spoiler for Redemption... No, Absolution Gap, which is the next book. That we're not... No, again, I don't want to bring it up too much. But it is one of those things you're going, well, we keep talking about this massive spaceship. We're going to have to use it for something, aren't we?
It's not only like they are kind of just pointing it out. They are... putting your face into the mud and say, look, this is the mud. This is it. This is the spaceship. Like, look at the spaceship. Like when it's big. It's really big. Look out there. It's right in front of you. It's super big. It's super big, you know?
It's got some really big engines. This is going to come in really handy later for something, isn't it? And we only bring this up because what they actually do with that, I was like, oh, well, they're going to attach it to the space station and blast it into the sun. But no, we're going to just smash it into the space station and set up rockets at the same time. And then they miss and it just disappears from the story. And that's what you were talking about before. You're like, what happened to that spaceship? No, nothing. They just flew it and it went somewhere. Where did it go? Somewhere. I thought that was going to be the prelude. Like all the Mormons would then revolt and say, you owe us a spaceship. Oh, it's like out there somewhere, but we missed and it's gone really far.
You can just get it back.
We can catch up with it. Actually, let's ask the person who doesn't have the inertial drive to go swing around there. Oh, yeah. And then the spaceship missing, the Naboo missing Eris Station because it just moves 200 kilometers to the left.
Yeah, and then it's just dropped. And there's this massive, really cool, big arc kind of thing. And when Miller, of course, Miller came up with the idea of it.
Of course
he did. What a surprise. And so Fred is the... Outer Belt Alliance
guy. Yeah.
At
this point.
And attached to their space station Tycho, they are building this really, really, really big
generation ship for the Mormons.
Yeah. So, and Miller says, oh, I have this great idea. Let's just take this really, really big ship and just smash it into the station.
No, he doesn't say that. He says, let's use that. And I thought this is going to be a clever plan. Yeah.
So, he says it, got to make sure no one gets into it until it's Corona. So it's like they want to shoot it towards the sun. Miller suggested that. And then Fred's breath grew slow and deep, his gaze flickering as if he were reading something in the air that only he could see. Miller didn't interrupt even when the silence got heavy. It almost a minute later that Fred let out a short percussive breath. The Mormons are going to be pissed, he said. So after 1 minute, maybe 2 minutes of silence and heavy breathing, he changed his mind and said, "All right, yeah, let's just take the ship that we built like for years and years and years and years."
The only thing that Tycho Station is doing, like, this is our main business, is building ships. And let's just throw all of that out. And
because
just,
this Miller guy just had the idea.
Had an idea. And I was just like, well, just blow it up. Oh, they live off radiation. Anyway, what this comes down to is that not only is that spaceship just forgotten, then we have this whole thing with, oh, and the aliens can just, the melding plate, no, what do they call it? Yeah, the proto...
Protogen.
The protogen molecule, the proto molecule, it can just manipulate the rules of space-time and get rid of inertia.
And physics.
And physics, yeah. And then inertia is not how... Now, and this comes back to the book that we're literally listening to between this as we were talking. Yeah, we've gone about an hour. Let's wrap it up in a few minutes. But in this book, Alistair Reynolds talks about, hey, we've developed this thing where inertial damping, so we can go faster than we could do normally and move around quicker because we dampen inertia. Now, in that book, it's like set up, oh, these people had to have a war to get the original stuff. We had to have things being sent back in time for the future to know that this is possible, like messages that way. We had to, and there was this thing, and there was this thing, and people went in and got this original research, and only one person came out alive. Now, after that, we worked for 40 years on this kind of stuff, and we even shut down all of the shipbuilding to do this thing because we thought, well, in the future, we're going to have this in our drives, and if we don't need it now, and we're going to have to escape from this other massive peril over here, stuff that's been sent out across the whole galaxy since, you know, billions of years ago. And all of this stuff over here, and then we're going to do this, and then they actually get onto one of these ships, and they don't know, and one more time, how come we're going so fast already? This isn't going to make sense. And then they go down, and they lead down the ship, and there's this whole thing. It's like the whole book is set up to say, you know, at some point, we're going to discover, like, humans are going to discover it, and it's going to be really, really hard work. It felt like to actually break that bit of physics, like dampening inertia in the Revelation space universe, it feels like it's taken three books to get to that point and a lot of work by a lot of people. Like, he put in the work in terms of explaining the science and how difficult it was to do that, to actually break that law of physics.
You kind of earned it at that point.
Yeah, the author and the book earned it. You can't just say, hey, let's shoot this spaceship at this rock. Missed. And that is it. That's all that happens. That's how the alien has developed it. That's suddenly, and they at some point they say, well, it's a little bit warmer over there, so at least it can, you know, it, energy went somewhere. They didn't just break the laws of energy because somewhere got a little bit hotter. Like, energy had to be expended, and they didn't do it perfectly efficiently. And I'm like, that is too easy. It comes back to this, like, anything indistinguishable from any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. But that is not a rule that you can just use to do magic stuff in your book. You have to make me believe that something isn't magic, that it is actually technology. And this book completely failed because it was just like, the whole setup of this book is like, no faster than light travel. Everything taking place with hard science fiction stuff within here. And when aliens turned up halfway through, I was like, okay, it turns out this is actually a first contact book, even though it didn't really feel like a first contact book. But it's one of those things that you just go, like, if you're setting up rules to say this is hard science fiction, it's set within our planet, this is in our future, you can't just suddenly go, oh, shit, the spaceship misses. And then ignore the spaceship and just go, oh, well, you know, one character's like, oh, well, it's a little bit warmer here. And that, you can't just say it's a little bit warm down here and that be explaining away inertial damping and stuff. Anyway, all I want to say is that just that being introduced at that point of the book, it's just too convenient. It feels like the latest Star Trek movies where they just go, oh, let's just inject this Tribble with something and it comes back to life. Oh, now let's do the same thing with Spock. No, not Spock, because Spock doesn't die in that one, does he? It's they just reverse that. You know, oh, this person can now teleport from one planet to another planet in a different solar system. And you're like, so why do we need warp drive anymore? Don't think of that. You know, it's that kind of thing. They just go, to get us out of this one problem, we'll just break the laws of physics in this universe and just go with it. And for that to happen before the end of the first book, to go, you know, like in the Revelation space world. It's like humans are intelligent, but they don't find they've never found any other human level intelligence. You know, there's the pattern jugglers, which are weird, and there's these other stuff, and there's this shrouders things going. There's this weird, you know, singularity over there, and they never find any other intelligent species. And you're like, that becomes a thing of the book. Like, when, why is that? When they turn up, it's a big thing. You know, like when other intelligences or when other aliens turn up, it's always a massive thing. And here, it's sort of like, oh, League of Evil did it, and they were keeping it secret. And you're like, that isn't thing that what?
And they were trying it out.
Yeah, it's like, oh, we wanted to give them lots of biomass. Why? Why do, like, who? Why? Who thought that was going to be a good, like, in which universe is this just part of what happens in normal life? And it's never happened before. It should be the biggest news ever. And it's just like, oh, let's just blow it all up. Yeah. No, let's just set it free. No, let's not do it. Oh, what should we do? Oh, let's just talk to it a bit. Ah, if we just talk to it, it'll be nice. Let's just give it Venus. And you just, and all the time I'm just like, no, blow it up. Actually blow it up. Like, why is, if you have a sample already, it's in a fridge. Blow it up. Don't give it Venus. Like, I never understood, like, what the rules were. Is it only humans at all the time, or is this thing that being sent back from the, you know, billions of years ago, is it a weapon to, like, to take over life, or is it meant to augment life or help? You know, none of those rules ever seemed to be set up in a way that was cohesive for the characters to know what the rules of the universe were.
Yeah.
In other space opera, the rules of the universe are always quite clearly defined, and people have expectations, and if something else happens outside of those expectations, it has to come through in the writing of the characters and the writing of society. And here it's like, oh, now aliens exist. And it was like, what do people say about this? Nothing, because there's a war going on. It's like, you know, it never really came back to me that, like, oh, this is actually a big thing, you know.
Yeah, this is. I think this is also a weak point, is that the book isn't concentrating on that one.
Yeah.
One really, really. It could have been a really clever storyline about.
But it just
this.
Felt disconnected from anything the characters were doing, yes. Even though that's what they were doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we've gone on a lot. Let me just look at my next. Oh yeah, some other weird writing. Holden dreamed having a nightmare about something. You have to do better than that. I've talked about that in many episodes. You can't just have someone having a nightmare about something to show me how bad it might be in the future. No, show me it being bad in the past. Show me that person having bad experiences in real time, and I'll believe that they're frightened about it. Don't just have them waking up in terrors.
No, also, at that point, they were talking a lot about how the Rocinante is going to be destroyed.
Yeah.
And at some point, if the more you tell that to me, what could happen?
Yeah.
The less I believe that anything could happen.
Yeah.
I actually made a note here in page.
In the ebook.
Yeah, in the ebook.
In your ebook.
Page 396 of 800 and something. So very at the beginning, I wrote down.
In the first half.
If Alex lost the game, they'd know it when the Rocinante was cut to pieces. And I wrote down, they won't until story ends. Told too often.
Yeah, so many times they get into a fight, and I understand that Alex is—he used to be in the Navy. He was the Martian, wasn't he? Yeah, he was in the Martian Navy. So he was in the Martian Navy. I understand that he's a hotshot pilot, but he hasn't been flying Navy ships for 20 years. But seems to suddenly just get into the latest ship and fly it, no problem. Okay, he's a hotshot pilot. It even says at one point, Naomi had only been in one space battle before, and now she was going like flying like an expert. And I was like, yeah, she's been in one space battle before, and now she's going up against the combined Martian and Earth fleet and winning on her second time ever behind a console. And, you know, it was just one of those things that you just go, this ship is only surviving because it is the Millennium Falcon. It is the Firefly. You know, it is the named ship that's going to make it through. You know, I never really thought, it never felt like it was actually, you know, all of the Red 5 team except Luke and who's the other one? Who's the other pilot in Star Wars who gets all the way through to the end? There's the other pilot who gets through.
You know, he's his friend.
His friend.
I don't know the names. I can't remember his name now.
I've just got the names of this book. I was like, his name's Holden. It's not. But, you know, you never really felt like anyone was in danger. Like, at the end of Star Wars, like, lots of people are dying that you know. You know, all of the green platoon, like Red 5, sign in, and you have all these people, you know, signing in, checking in, and you just then see them dying one after the other. And at this book, it just doesn't, at the start of it, it does happen, but at the end, it's never like, oh, and this person goes off in it, and they die, and this person goes, but this one gets through. It was just like, yeah, the ship went up against these spaceships and survived.
Yeah, and even in the situation when you think, ah, now they really get blown up now. You kind of know that they don't.
Yeah.
Because it happens like 70% or like, yeah, 30% towards the end. So, you know, there's still a bit to go.
And there's still another mission that I've got to go on.
They can't die.
Yeah.
And this was always so, I wouldn't say disappointing, but it's so many things in that book were so predictable.
Yeah. Oh, it's so, so predictable. And even at the end, like, again, bringing it back to Star Wars, there's this great thing. Oh, and also RoboCop. I've seen these things where they say, actually, these movies are mirror versions of each other. And they go through RoboCop and they say all the scenes leading up to this point, you know, they have this bit here and they go that bit there. He starts off saying his name and then does this and gets inside and has this fight and goes like that. And it's the same with Empire Strikes Back. They go, right, at the beginning, Han goes out to save Luke. Luke is hanging upside down. He does it by the, you know, this, and they go through, and at the end you're like, oh, Han goes back to save Luke. Luke is hanging upside down. And the whole movie is kind of like mirrored up against, like mirrored against each other. When he does this at the start, it's mirrored at this point at the end. And at the end of this book, it says, he'd come full circle. Once, in a different light, he'd taken the task of finding her. Then, when he'd failed, there was taking advantage. Now he had the chance to find her again, to save her. I'm like, I get it. You're meant to be finding this girl all the way through. You're meant to be finding this girl, and you found her once. And then, now at the end of the book, what are you doing? You're doing the thing that you were told to do in chapter one, that you were told to find this girl and save her. And now what are you doing? You're going to find the girl and save her. And I was like, this could have been clever writing. And I was like, oh, it's all come full circle. And then I get to the bit where he says, full circle. He'd come full circle. Once in a different life, he had taken the task of finding. I'm like, yeah, don't just tell me that. Like, why are you spelling out to me the writing techniques and story techniques that you're using to convince me, like, to actually engage me in the story by telling me this? It's like that thing. Yes. Like, by telling me that you'd read Blue Mars and you're going to name your faction Blue Mars after this terraforming group. It's like,
you know about Don Quixote.
And I know about Don Quixote and all these other things. It's like, by telling me that in the text, it is no longer subtext. It is now the text. It is now the super text. It is now what the book is about, instead of informing my enjoyment of the book.
The weird thing is that
I've said everything I want to say.
Now it seems that we're kind of like really going up against the book in every single way.
No, it's just an average book, and we're explaining why this book, it's got all the elements we like from
this is why,
from
why
space opera, but just not
we
done as
finish
well.
Finish it.
Yeah.
This is why this is a book I finished, no problem. It has, like, I stayed up late reading through it. No problem at all. I was never going to not finish it. It had interesting things, and it was appealing in some ways.
But it was an okay story.
But if you have a scale in front of you, and you put things that make you read a book on one side, and then you have the other side, and you put things that why you don't really like it. And I think now we put a lot to the page to the side. Well, why we don't like it. It really is averaging itself out.
It does. It's like, it's for me, it's one of those 2.5 books. It's like, none of the writing is bad enough to make me go, oh, I can't believe I'm reading this. But it's all of it is like that. Like I say, these just examples here. It's like, these writers know what they're doing, but it's just like, didn't neither of them, like these two authors, didn't one of them go, hey, you know that bit where we explain our writing technique? Maybe we should take that out. Like, hey, you know that bit where we're like dropping these literary allusions? Maybe we could just tone that down a bit, so only at the very end, like everyone can feel clever all the way through to the end, instead of people saying, I'm going to name my ship after this. You know, like if it was just a literary allusion and then at the very end someone goes, oh, I actually picked up on that reference. You're like, oh, that's very clever. You know, are those things that you'd actually, like, that I want from... I don't know. It's one of those things that, like, I know this. This was nominated for a Hugo.
Didn't get it, though.
Didn't get it. But then I'm thinking, why is Alistair Reynolds, like, how could Alistair Reynolds go through his entire life writing much, much, much better, more complex, more interesting, more competent? Not everything about his books is better than this book. Like, not all of Alistair Reynolds' characters are always great. I'm not saying that he's a fantastic writer, but, like, if you're going to write this style of science fiction about someone called the Butcher of Tharsis / Anderson and getting into Corvettes, and there's going to be a melding plague, and there's going to be inertia dampening systems, like, all of the stuff that's right there in Revelation space. If it's going to be noir detective solves a problem with evil corporations like it is in The Prefect, in the Revelation space thing, you know, if it's going to be about terraforming, if it's going to be about colony ships, like, why don't you just read The Prefect and then Chasm City and then the Revelation space, no, or whatever order they were written. Like, why aren't you just reading that? They are chunky books. They are harder work, but the payoff in every single case is a real payoff. Like at the end of the third book in the Revelation Space series, at the end of Absolution Gap, you read that and go, I have come on a journey that is worth it. You know, I've come on a thing and I've learned things about the universe and I've learned things about humanity and I've learned things about technology and I've learned things about astrophysics and I've learned stuff about, you know, writing and I've learned stuff about literature and I've learned all of this massive wide scale that I actually want from space opera. And again, like reading through the culture series, like that goes through 10,000 years of history. And you come out at the other end of it and thinking, wow, I've lived through something. You know, I've experienced something. And reading Leviathan Wakes, I got to the end of it and I was like, well, there were some asteroids and a thing and there was a car chase.
Yeah, as a reader, you just don't feel so attached to it because it is kind of everything is explained very well. And it's just not, you just don't feel proud of yourself because you're solving all the problems too easy. It's like all the clever hints, all the clever ideas, all the clever how the story might go. It everything is kind of spoiled.
Yeah, but it was like this thing. Okay, so they find Julia. She's been taken over by the melding plague, and I'm just like, okay. At the end, like, she's obviously not going to be dead, and and also Miller has her in the brain all this time, and I'm just like, this is really obvious. You can't keep beating me over the head that Miller is obsessed with this girl and thinks that he's in love. It's like, this is going to be the key to the end of the book. There's nothing in this book which makes me think that when he gets back to that station at the end, that his connection with Julia is going to save the day at the end. That was what the story was about, and it was like this massive, great spaceship, the Naboo spaceship from the moment. I'm just being punched in my face with the solution to the whole book. And guess what happens at the end? That thing happened. Like, I was just not surprised, you know.
And that's it. And the thing with Julia, like, all the way through, I was thinking, maybe he got infected by just a tiny bit.
Yeah,
and
I actually made that note in the book as well.
And now she's kind of in his brain to like, because he behaved somehow really weird at some points. You think, she's like Luke just wrote a song about a zombie pilot, which really fits. But like, he is getting piloted by Julie, who is making him doing all this thing to then go
back
have
to her,
this great goal to do that something.
Yeah, and I actually made a note here all the way through because I was thinking, maybe this is, sure, it's a little bit like the wind-up girl warmed over again with someone like someone dying and then the other person carrying them away. And I've seen that happen in other books as well. I'm just saying that wind-up girl is probably the best known one, Hugo award-winning book as it was. But, you know, I made a note here, Julia Mayo leaned on a... Paula Mayo. Julia Mayo leaned on a table where Amos had been. And I was like, is this more than a delusion? Like, is it a delusion? I thought it was a delusion. I thought this is going to be a very handy, helpful delusion. Mm. It's going to, you know, he's going to be justified in his, you know, weird, creepy, middle-aged, midlife crisis, alcoholic, dependent.
How old was she?
I don't know. I'd say thinking 20s, in her 20s anyway.
How old is he?
Yeah, midlife crisis time. You know, he was in his 40s, she was in her 20s. But I thought, this is going to work out. This obsession is actually going to be justified. It's going to be, he is utterly creepy and is totally disturbing what he is. But in the end, that's going to be the thing that saves the day. That was in the forefront. It wasn't even like this little thing in the back of my mind going, I wonder if this is going to be helpful later on. No, it wasn't. It was like, now, I'm saying that Alistair Reynolds, Ian M. Banks, Peter Half Hamilton, they have all of these things in the book, but there's just more going on. Like Alistair Reynolds, like every four chapters, there's a mystery of this level being set up and solved, and they're like, and now on to the next level. Oh, and now there's this more politics, now there's this deeper level of alien technology, and now over here there's this other thing going, and there's another faction, you know, on top of every single time anything happens, you're like, and there's this other thing, which is this time travel, or is it aliens and all this other stuff? All the time, it's just layer upon layer upon layer going through all of his books. And in this, it was like three chapters of Alistair Reynolds spread over 57 chapters. You know, it was like that kind of short, much shorter chapters. But that's the kind of level that we're looking at. And that's the thing that I was seeing anyway. That was the level that I was looking at in a lot of this. Anyway, your final thoughts before we wrap up this 2.5 book, this perfect 2.5 book.
Well, I say 3 stars because I'm putting my my points up on Goodreads things.
Oh, okay.
But I was doing a podcast, I was thinking, why was it more than a three-star book than a two-star book? And I can't really say why. I think it's just also because I just read it and it wasn't like...
It wasn't a bad book. It just wasn't... I'm just used to when... If you're going, this is space opera for this kind of stuff, I would just rather watch Star Wars again. I would rather watch... I'd rather watch the first two episodes of Firefly
By the way,
again.
this year they are putting out a TV series, The Expanse.
Yeah, it's just
really want to see that.
It could be good.
How it is.
It could be good.
The thing is now, the question is that is more pressing than... how good was this book? Is are we going to continue?
What, this series?
Yeah.
No. I mean, if people email in and send us messages on Twitter and Goodreads and all that kind of stuff, if people say, oh, this series carries on and it just gets better and better every time and it gets more complex and it gets better written and all that kind of stuff, but will it? I don't know. There's nothing in this book which makes me think this is remarkable. I totally understand why it was nominated for Hugo Awards, but like, I'm not a Hugo Award kind of book. You know, like, why that's not something for me. You know, I realize this science fiction isn't for me. This science fiction is for people who start reading an Alistair Reynolds book or a Peter F. Hamilton book and go, wow, this is a bit too chunky. I need something
lighter.
Or maybe
if you start reading science fiction, maybe this is a good way of getting into it.
It's because probably a great book to get into science fiction.
When you don't have so much of an overview of, like, the real space opera.
Yeah, what space opera could be,
then
you'd be satisfied with this.
Probably.
Anyway, that's enough. Let's wrap it up. I give it 2.5 stars. You give it 3 stars. Yeah. What does it come out? It's 2.75?
Yeah.
Or 2.5? What are you going to do?
I say...
3 stars.
Yeah, just...
Okay, 2.75, the most average book, even though we've shit on it from a great height.
It's okay.
From the top of the gravity well to the bottom of the gravity well.
I guess,
it's okay.
It's good. All right.
That's it. Email me, luke@juggler.net. I do reply to every email. You can become my friend and Juliana's friend on goodreads.com. Also, check out the SFBRP listener group there. We're talking about all kinds of stuff and books you'd like to see reviewed and other things. What were you going to say, Juliana?
I just wanted to say that I got a very nice offer of Model Hoff that he said, oh, if you want to listen to it as an audiobook, he knows what he wrote. Thanks for that. It's really nice to give me that offer.
Okay. And we don't need it. We have plenty of Audible credits if we're going to continue with the series.
I'm like 5 credits behind.
It's because you keep buying ebooks and things like that.
No, the thing is, I don't have so much time to listen to audiobooks. The only places where I'm listening to audiobooks is on the U-Bahn. Or
when we're driving
and then we listen to something in English.
Yeah.
And I rather prefer German audiobooks to relax and hang out and just get something into my head.
Also, there is an audiobook of this, Leviathan Wakes.
It is.
So
it is
on
there.
Audible. So go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP. Start a free trial. Listen to this book. I was told that the narrator was okay, but he didn't distinguish the voices very much. And that's why we got this one. This is why I was happy to read this as an ebook. And I thought I'd enjoy this as an ebook. And I did. It was an okay read. Like I say, it kept me up at night reading. Like, I mean, it didn't immediately put me to sleep reading it. You know, I read it and enjoyed it.
Yeah, this is why I give it 3 stars. Because
it did the job.
Get me up to read it like till 2 o'clock or something.
For me, on a chapter by chapter basis, I enjoyed it, but on like a large scale, I didn't enjoy it. Does that make sense? Like individual sentences and individual scenes and chapters, I actually found enjoyable. But I was like, why are we just going back to the same space station again? Why are we going back to another place which is exactly the same?
You don't need to defend yourself. Why you find it like kind of good, but not really? Like it's an average book in every way.
That's it.
All right. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening. Catch you later. No, catch you next time. I almost forgot my normal sign off there. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time. That's it.